Hello, you are listening to Different Bits, a bite of art after the news. Our guest today is Australian new media artist John McCormack. Hello, John, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hi, Heather, how are you?
Good. So, would you like to introduce yourself to our audience, John?
Okay. John McCormack. I'm a new media artist. I work in the area of artificial life and synthesis of biological processes in the computer, and I've been doing that for about more than 12 years now, and I guess most of my work is done exclusively using the computer, so I try and mimic the way that biological processes work using computer programs, computer software.
Before we delve into your work specifically, could you give us some background on what artificial life is?
Okay, so many, many years ago, there was a workshop held in New Mexico, and there was a person there called Chris Langton who coined this term called artificial life, and he was interested in the way that you could simulate lifelike processes and behaviours in media other than real life, which is biological life that we find on Earth. So the basic idea is that the life that we know, which is everything around us that we call living, is just one instance of a broader category of something that's alive. And the only way to really test this theory was to try and make things that we could call alive in other media. And the most obvious medium seemed to be computers at the time, and probably still is the predominant way that artificial life is practiced, although a lot of people are beginning to use things like other chemistries rather than carbon-based chemistry to try and simulate lifelike processes. But the computer is the main way in which artificial life attempts to be made. And I suppose one thing I should say too is that it's a fairly controversial idea, and that not everyone thinks that it's possible. And there's sort of two basic camps or two basic modes of thought. And one group of people think that artificial life can only ever be a simulation of life. So anything that we create in the computer that we call alive will just be a simulation. It won't be really alive. And then there's another group of people who disagree with that and think that we can actually make things that we could confidently call alive inside a computer, which is a big philosophical issue at the moment, but not really practical because nobody's got anything near what we would consider to be alive in the computer so far.
It does, however, raise questions of how we can define life.
It makes you think about, well, what does it really mean to be alive? And it's pretty easy for us to just look at something and say, yes, that's alive, or no, that's a desk or a chair or a rock. But when you start thinking about it more deeply, there are lots of things that are really at the edge of being alive. So if you think about things like viruses, for instance, a virus is sort of alive, but it's not really alive without a host. It's just a whole bunch of complex molecules floating around, and they only really start to do something when they have a host in them. So it's part of the time it's alive, and part of the time it's really fairly inert. And then also, even if we think about ourselves, we have a conscious experience of being alive, which really dictates a lot of the way that we think about what life is. But we sort of forget that we spend a lot of our time asleep where we're unconscious, and we don't really know that we're alive. We're not conscious of the fact that we're living, even though, of course, if you see someone who's asleep, you have no doubt in knowing that they're alive. So if we think about things like conscious awareness and so on, there's still things that are very problematic in terms of understanding what it means to be alive. So I guess this is something that people are always thinking about when they're making artificial life, is what really defines living processes and living systems. And there's been quite a bit of progress in that area.
Do you believe that if something acts like a living creature, or if we perceive it as a living creature, then it would define it as being alive?
Well, no. I mean, I think if you look at the history of artificial life, actually goes back a long way before computers, even though it wasn't called artificial life then. So there's been some very famous examples of people who've tried to make creatures that fooled people into thinking that they were alive. So there's a very famous duck that was made that actually did everything that a real duck did. So it quacked and walked around and ate food, and it even excreted at its rear end as well, and people had to clean up after it. But it was really just a mechanical illusion, if you like. And so it had behaviours that people associated with being alive, but it really wasn't anything like a real duck. And so people were fooled into thinking that that it was alive in some way, that this mechanical duck was really living. And I think there's a similar parallel with a lot of the computer simulations that people put together today that they call artificial life, is that really they're just probably tricks is not the right word, but they're illusions. It's pretty easy to fool people, I guess, is one way of thinking about it, into thinking that something has or is alive if it behaves like something that's alive. But you really have to look deeper than that and say, well, what are the mechanisms that are actually driving this thing that makes me think that it's alive? And most of the examples that people have demonstrated so far, I think, have been closer to being called tricks or illusions of life rather than genuine examples of life. And in fact, the things that really probably demonstrate artificial life at its best are the things that actually don't look like life and are very unconvincing, and they're often just shown as graphs or very simple graphic patterns in the computer, but they're actually demonstrating features about living systems in computer systems that some of the more sort of graphically rich examples perhaps don't have.
That's interesting. And how does artificial life differ from artificial intelligence?
Well, artificial life is probably something that could be considered a sort of sub-branch of artificial intelligence. It's assumed that if you make something living, that in order to actually survive, you've got to have some degree of intelligence anyway. So being able to survive in any environment, be it a computer-based environment or a real-world environment, probably needs some degree of intelligence. So I think it's sort of been a bit of a breath of fresh air for people working in artificial intelligence in the sense that perhaps an older style of artificial intelligence thought of everything as being symbolic, as being symbolic manipulation. And it's turned out that that's really hasn't been that successful in uncovering basic ideas about intelligence or generating systems that are what we might call genuinely intelligent rather than using sort of tricks to pretend that they're intelligent or having intelligence in very limited domains, like, for instance, playing chess or solving specific queries about medical problems or something like that. The great thing about artificial life systems is that they're really capable of open-ended behavior that you didn't program into them or expect to happen. So it emerges from some sort of lower-level interaction. And that's what really is exciting about it as an artist too, is that you can actually create systems that have something in them that you didn't necessarily put them directly or design or anticipate would happen. It emerges through this complex process of interaction between individual components of the program or the computer program and the people interacting with it.
So would you say that as an artist you look to be surprised by your work?
I think that's one aspect of it. As an artist, you're always thinking, how do I go about the process of making art in a way that's going to do more than I kind of designed something to do? And I always get really annoyed in the computer industry where people talk about programs being limited by your imagination, because my imagination is very limited, and I want to be able to do things that I can't imagine, that I can't necessarily design explicitly. And I think that's what really attracted me to the idea of artificial life in the first place, was that you could actually create systems that generated things that you didn't put in them specifically. So you've got emergent behaviour, emergent patterns or forms coming out of the system, which would be difficult or impossible to actually think up in your imagination. And I think that's a fundamentally different way of using the computer as a tool than more traditional methods where you're just painting with the computer or using it as a sort of shooter paint program or something that mimics the way that theatre or animation works. So that you can actually synthesize things that you couldn't imagine seems like a pretty exciting idea.
Definitely very exciting. Can you tell us about your installation, Eden?
Maybe I should, before telling you about that, I should say about some of the ideas behind my work are really to make people, ask people questions about what it means to be alive and what machines might offer in terms of the way that they view living systems and so forth, but also a recognition of the way that real nature is being so quickly destroyed. So Eden is an artificial ecosystem. It's a computer world that's populated by very simple creatures that make and listen to sound, and they have a very simple graphic representation, so they don't look like any creature that you're ever likely to encounter in the real world. But what's interesting about them is that they have very complex behaviours, and these weren't programmed in to the computer. It has a kind of a simple learning mechanism where the creatures can learn certain behaviours, and the criteria for learning those behaviours is basically what helps them to survive in this artificial world. And the artificial world is somewhat like a metaphor of the real world in the sense that there's food for them to eat and obstacles that they have to avoid, that they can fight each other, that they can eat each other if they want to, but also that they can make sound and they can hear sound as well, and they have very acute ability to generate sound. So what happens is that over a period of time, the creatures learn about their environment and they learn to survive, and some, through a genetic process, evolve very complex behaviours in order to survive in the world. But what makes it sort of interesting in an artistic sense is that it operates in a real space and that there are sensors into the real world. So people viewing the installation come into a darkened room with translucent screens with these very strange projections on them, and they hear sounds. And the presence of people in the space generates food for the creatures. So if people are inside the space moving around and looking and listening to what they're doing, the creatures get rewarded with food. So if the sounds that they're making are really terrible and make people want to leave, then they lose out food, and so eventually they die. So basically you get this implicit symbiotic relationship between people in the audience and the creatures themselves, in that they learn to make interesting sounds to keep people within the space of the installation, and so hence generate more food for themselves so they keep alive for longer. So this results in a very complex engagement between the artificial creatures and the people who visit the exhibition space. But visiting the exhibition space is all you have to do. There's no interface that you have to operate or learn. It's just simply your presence and your interest in the work itself that keeps the creatures alive and keeps them finding new melodies, new ways to combine sounds together to keep you there and hence increase their food supply. And I think that's what makes it interesting to experience, is that you get a kind of a dynamic behaviour that they'll do things that you didn't expect, that I didn't program in order to keep people there. So it's an interesting symbiotic relationship.
You seem to devote a lot of attention to sound in this work in particular. What is it about the relationship between sound and artificial life that intrigues you?
Well, I think a lot of the earlier examples of artificial life very much focused on visual simulation. And as we were talking about before, it's fairly easy to make very complex computer graphic images that, in a sense, trick people into thinking that this looks like something that's alive and it acts like something that's alive and it looks very realistic, so it must be alive. Whereas with sound, it's a more interesting and more open-ended, I think, way of exploring this idea, and it's not so much bound by a lot of cultural baggage about what constitutes realism and what being alive might be. And also that I think just as a way of exploring a particular aesthetic, that it's very much underused in installation in artistic installations. So the work has a visual component as well, but that's really played down mm-hmm. to the idea that sound becomes the predominant focus for the work. And so I think also in terms of the way, just internally, that the program works, the idea of making new sounds seems to be something that does actually keep people interested, because they have to spend time to actually listen to them rather than making, for instance, pictures or some other visual media that you can basically just look at and then right. and then leave. Sound invites you to stay for longer because you can keep listening to sound for a longer period of time, I think.
How do people generally react to your installations? Like, do they usually spend a lot of time with them?
It's pretty varied. I know with a recent exhibition that I had of Eden, there was an office worker who had come from his office to the show. It was on for a month or so, and he'd come every day at lunchtime, wow. and he said, this is better than sitting outside, sitting amongst the potted plants and everything. This nature seemed to be more interesting to me. Another person said it was like being in a forest and listening to you know, sounds, but not sounds that they were familiar with, sounds that they'd never heard before, and that's what made them interested. And I mean, I even find kids are really interested in kind of a different level of engagement. I think that they start to get a sense of what the interaction might be, so mm-hmm. they keep moving around to try and get mm-hmm. the creatures in the installation to make more sound and to I don't know if you actually call it play, but there's a certain degree of interaction in sort of a way that you might interact with animals, simple animals in an ecosystem or something like that, that you spend a lot of time observing them, but then you try and interact with them in some way, even though you're not sure about how that interaction might take place, because obviously they're electronic and virtual, and as I said, there's no interface, there's no buttons to push or anything like that, simply based around your presence in the space. So you have to use your body more in terms of your interaction, and I think that's probably what people find interesting about it as well.
But do children pick up on the interactive element faster than adults do, you found?
Sorry, I didn't hear that. Can you repeat the question?
Was it children that were picking up faster on the interactive elements,
rather than adults? I think children really have... I think they're less inhibited in terms of the way that they interact with electronic spaces. I think adults felt very self-conscious of the fact that they're moving around inside this weird space with very strange shapes being projected all over the place and making these sounds. Whereas I think children probably have less inhibition about doing strange things or understanding the way something works, because it works at a very low level of interaction, if I can use that term, that there's not a lot of intellectual engagement in the sense of reading or action-reaction. So if I do this, this will happen. It's much more open-ended. So it's more of a process of exploration and discovery that way. And I think children are very good at in terms of finding out about the world, they're very good at exploring environments to discover about how they work, whereas adults tend to sort of sit back and use a lot of knowledge that they had perhaps when they were children as well to do that. So I think, yeah, that's probably one reason why there's that mode of engagement.
Continuing with the subject of interactivity, in your paper Evolving for the Audience, you discuss the idea of experiencing context and draw the distinction between work that is interactive and work that is reactive. Could you elaborate a little bit more on these ideas?
Well, I think if you look at the history of electronic media, and particularly interactive media, a lot of emphasis has been placed on interface and all the sorts of problems and benefits about computer interfaces. So there's a huge history of computer interfaces in the computer industry itself, but largely they've been in the service of making programs what people often or used to term user-friendly, for instance. But really what they're about is sort of serving an idea about productivity and business and all those sorts of things. And I think the way that most people are used to using computers is pretty ineffectual, mm-hmm. unless, of course, you want to run a spreadsheet or a word processor. Mm-hmm. But if you're interested in engagements with machines that are different than that, that are not about, you know, business or achieving some goal through some sort of action-reaction mechanism, right. and also not necessarily about play in the sense that you would play with a toy or something like that, but something richer and deeper, I think this is this is an area that's really underexplored, is the idea of creating systems that are reactive to you but not necessarily interactive, in the same way that the world is reactive to us. But it's not interactive necessarily in the sort of action-reaction sense. So when you, if you go for a walk in a forest, you interact with that forest in a sense, but you also, it's reactive to your presence there. So animals might be scared off by you. They mightn't want to interact with you. They might run away if you're too loud or too noisy or you smell or whatever. And so my goal is really to try and design electronic systems that operate in a similar way, in the same way that ecosystems might operate, in that they exist, they have behaviours, they will react to information in their environment from humans or from other creatures. But there's not a direct, necessarily, or an obviously direct relationship between doing something like pushing a button, clicking on a mouse, and getting a response from that mm-hmm. instantaneously. Some of the reactions that do form from these relationships might take much longer to occur, or they might be much more ambiguous. And really, if you think about it, there are lots of things in nature that are reactive in the sense that you can interact with them in a sense, but there's no language of interaction. It's not like I do something and I'm guaranteed to get the same response every time. And that's the sort of thing that I'm trying to explore in some of these works.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting in that paper you were talking about sort of the language learning curve of interactivity in installations, and how sort of for every different electronic installation you have to learn a new language of interactivity. And it sounded like you were describing in your work you were using this sort of evolving system of reactivity to get around some of the...
Well, that's right. I think a lot of as I said, works, you know, artworks and even works that aren't artworks that are just called interactive mm-hmm. require you to learn a certain language in order to get the most out of them. And the problem with artworks in particular is that each artwork, as it is different and perhaps addressing different issues or working in a different way, has a language that you need to learn. And the problem that I found in experiencing a lot of these works, because I've sort of seen quite a few of them, was that you had to spend a huge amount of time learning the language of the interactivity for a specific work in order to understand a lot about the work. Now, if you're in a gallery environment, you may not have hours or days to sit down and play with something mm-hmm. or to work out, you know, what that language really is. And I think it really plays down sort of the experiential and spatial nature of interface, and particularly in the way that interfaces can involve the body as a whole rather than just the hand. So most people, again, when they're using computers in a conventional mode, are sitting down at a desk or a table or on a chair, and they move very little of their body. If you sit and watch someone using a computer or playing a video game, look at how little their body usually moves. It's just a little movement with their hand, and you watch their eyes are following the screen, even though they might be cognitively really actively involved in some sort of scenario or some virtual world. Their body is basically static. And so I think there's been a number of important artworks and new media that have really addressed this issue of embodiment and using the whole body as an interface and so on. And so this is a sort of an extension of that in a way, in that rather than just doing something in action like a click, it's just there is no predefined language about clicking or moving or anything like that. It's something that you just have to, you be there, you do something, and the system is guaranteed to not to react to that necessarily, but to take that in terms of how it constitutes itself. But you don't have to learn a language. You don't have to say, if I click on this, will it do that? Because there is no clicking to be done. Or if I move my hands in this way, will I get this response? Well, no, you may not, or yes, you may. But that's not really the point of interaction in this mode.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it does seem like a lot of times you end up spending so much time with a piece of artwork trying to figure it out, you know, that you don't actually get to thinking about what it is about. And sort of concentrating
on the ideas. Yeah, well, I think it can distract from the message or the ideas that are being explored in the work. Is if you're stuck trying to learn the interface, or even just focusing on that and saying, well, if I do this, what will happen? Or if I do that, what will happen? That In terms of the actual experiential nature of the work, which I think is important in any work that's presented in a public context, is how that I, how does that detract from the real ideas that the work is trying to impart to the viewer, if indeed that's what it's trying to do. And I think a lot of it is really bogged down in the whole way that computers are made and constructed, and that to build, custom interfaces is a very difficult and time-consuming problem, and that computers and software and the way that they work is not designed. They're designed for one mode of interaction, which, right. As I said before, is really just serving the needs of business and industry and so on, and that they're purely functional objects largely. So I think it's really interesting to think about machines in other ways. What would machines be like if they were more autonomous, if they had the ability to make decisions that we didn't necessarily have direct control over, that we could react or interact with them in ways that aren't like the ways that we react with them now? And these are sort of questions that we'll really have to ask as ideas from artificial life and technology changes. And I think if we're thinking about how we can use computers in a way that's just not about functional roles, that we have other roles, aesthetic roles, creative roles, and so on, then these are some of the issues that people need to be addressing in the longer term over the next 50 or 100 years in terms of the role of computation and computers in society, in nature, and in life in general. How do we make machines that aren't just about word processing or painting or anything like that have a genuinely new mode of interaction.
Mm. Can you talk about how Eden has evolved over the years and why you made the changes you've made?
Sure. I've been working on the work for quite a while. As with most of the works that I've done, they've taken a fair amount of time, and they're really, to use sort of a cliche, they're evolutionary in the sense that they start off with one particular idea, and then the potential for that idea to be expanded becomes possible only after the initial idea is being implemented. So originally, I was actually working on another project at the same time, which was a sculptural project for a new cultural centre that was being built here in Melbourne. And this was a very long and complicated process, and I was working with architects and engineers, and there are huge amounts of details that need to be worked out, and you almost forget that you're an artist when you get into this mode, because you're just basically dealing with drawings and plans and public liability and how can we clean this thing and how long will it last for and what's the longevity of this component versus that and so on. And I really just wanted to make something that was simple and easy and that I could do very quickly. So it started off really as being a kind of a game. I just wanted to explore a very simple environment where I could show people about what artificial life was about and show that here is a creature, here is its simple environment. You can see this symbol represents food and this symbol represents an obstacle, and okay, let's watch them behave. And you can see at first they don't really know what to do and they just wander around aimlessly, but then look, this one's learned how to eat, and slowly it's learning to avoid bumping into the obstacles, and now this one has learnt to fight the other one and to defend itself or to run away. Very simple, trivial kind of behaviours in this simple world. But then as the project kind of grew, I wanted to get a different engagement with the audience. And so along the lines of what we were just talking about in terms of interaction, the original interface was very much a conventional interface in the sense that you just clicked on things and moved sliders around to interact with the software. But I really wanted to turn it into something that was more, that reminded you of nature, not by the fact that it looked natural at all, but just in its behaviour. And I guess that's a common thing about all the work that I produce, is that hopefully it reminds you of something about nature, that something that you've never seen in nature before. And so it really just grew from there. And then the idea of some way of making the system reactive to the audience came, and basically it developed from there. And then after a few exhibitions of observing the way that people responded to it and so on, I made some changes, particularly in terms of the visual representation that was simplified even further, as we were talking about before, to make people focus more on the sound until it's in its present form, which it's in now, which I'm fairly happy with.
And so currently you're in the process of rewriting the code and adding video capture? Is that right?
So one of the well, not really the problems, but one of the difficulties is that the current version uses infrared sensors, so it has a large number of infrared sensors, and these sensors measure people's movement and presence, but they can't really give that much information except that something is moving in this area and it's this far away and it's moving with this speed.
Mm-hmm.
So the next stage in the project for exhibitions that are coming up is to replace that technology with a new technology. It's basically using video capture, because it's really easy now to just get a couple of webcams or several webcams and to process the information that's coming from them in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And so hopefully the next stage in the development of this project will be more complicated interactions between the audience and the artificial creatures themselves, so that the way that they react to people within the space will be even more developed and more intricate. And I mean, it will give the work more of a subtlety and open-ended behaviours. We were talking about before, the whole thing about artificial life systems is their ability to be open-ended in their behaviour, to come up with new possibilities that you didn't program into the system. And I think by increasing the fidelity and the way that the system can respond to people should make the way that you can interact with it even more interesting, so you can come back again and again and discover new ways of basically seeing responses in the system for what it is that you're doing there.
What has surprised you most in this work?
I think the thing that surprises, well, there's two things that surprise me. One thing that surprises me when I'm actually doing it is that a computer is actually capable of doing things that you didn't put into it, or giving you a response that you didn't expect. I think that's, as I said before, I think that's a fundamentally new way of working with machines, that you can get things that emerge through interactions that you hadn't actually programmed in there, and it's, especially in a creative sense, that you can get things out of a system that you didn't design or put into them explicitly. The second thing I think is really interesting is in terms of the way that people react with the system, the way they interact and the things that they get out of it. And again, this is a whole other area of emergent phenomenon in that, I mean, when I make a work, I'm not really thinking consciously about, well, what will people get out of this? It's not a didactic educational mm-hmm. experience. It's really to do with my fascination and wonderment about the world and
mm-hmm.
Our place in it and how nature works and our relationship with it. But also the way that people interact with the system and the ideas that they get from it are things that I would never have anticipated or thought about, but they still seem to be very rewarding. And I guess that's one of the rewarding things about making an artwork, that people can actually see the world in a different way after experiencing it. And I'm not saying that everybody who goes in there has this experience, but a number of people have come up to me and said, I never thought about nature this way, or it's really changed the way I think about experiencing real nature, or what it means to be alive, or what natural systems are and so on, or what computers are capable of as well. So I think those kinds of responses are really interesting as well, and really surprising, in the sense that you might think, well, people might enjoy this, or they might be moved by it, or they might be disgusted by it, or whatever. But I think the thing that I didn't necessarily anticipate was that it would actually, in many cases, question the way people think about their real environment, not just the artwork itself.
Could you tell us a little about your movie called Turbulence?
Yeah, sure. Turbulence is an older work than Eden that we've been discussing, and it's very different, I guess, than Eden visually. It was after I heard about this idea of artificial life in the late 1980s, early 1990s, I wanted to write some artificial life software, and so writing the software was a very, very long and tedious process, and it took about a year to write. But at the time I was writing it, I was really thinking a lot more about evolution, biology, nature, natural spaces, and so on. And eventually, sort of a whole lot of ideas came together about creating life in the computer, what that meant, what it meant to be alive. More importantly, I think also, the rapid destruction of natural spaces, so the way that nature had been completely changed by people, by the presence of people, particularly in the industrialized world, had inflicted huge changes on nature. And so I began reading about poets and biologists and just thinkers and philosophers from even hundreds of years ago at the start of the Industrial Revolution, and how they had very similar ideas. So they noticed with the advent of the Industrial Revolution how forests were being cut down, trees were being pulled up, landscapes were being destroyed in the name of, you know, progress, and that this had really affected them very strongly, that they were seeing things happen in their lives that had never happened in the history of civilization before, and on a scale that was really, even hundreds or 200 years ago, was really very significant. And I could see the same thing happening here. So I kind of had this idea that, well, what if we were replacing nature and we needed nature? I think it's an aesthetic necessity. It's also that, I mean, apart from any sort of resources that it provides, it's also very much an aesthetic necessity. I mean, if we lived in a place without any natural systems at all, it'd be a pretty boring and horrible place to live in. So I began thinking about, well, what would the natural systems, if they were to disappear, how would we replace this desire to have natural systems around us? And so could we create our own nature inside the computer? So Turbulence as a Work was really a response to this idea, and to say, well, what kind of palatable or possible natures could we make in a computer to replace the natural spaces that we're destroying so quickly? And so the work is really a sort of embodiment of these ideas. It's an interactive museum of unnatural history. So inside the computer, there's a whole series of imaginary creatures that have been evolved using these artificial life techniques. And they're classified, and they have a natural history that's all fictitious, but it's drawn from biological texts, again, from sort of 200 years ago when biologists were coming up and discovering new species for the first time. So going to exotic locations in Asia and in Australia, for instance, and uncovering all these fantastic, amazing new species and the reactions that they had about them. And so I sort of paraphrased a lot of those ideas and built them into this new futuristic museum of creatures that had never existed in reality. So they have a taxonomy and a history and behaviours and things that you can see in the museum. Of course, they never really existed. The space that they're from doesn't exist, but it's projected on a big, large video projector, sort of cinematic-style projection system, and you see all these very luscious and beautiful images, animated images of imaginary creatures that were evolved in the computer. And so I think it's really the kind of basic idea of the work is a philosophical meditation about life, evolution and nature, and it offers a possibility for the way that we might experience nature in the future.
As an artist who creates these complex artificial worlds, you might say, what position does it put you in the relationship between nature being increasingly replaced by artificial nature?
Well, I think it's an important question. It's probably one thing that most people don't really think about because they're not aware that this is a lot of this research is going on, or perhaps what its potential might be. I think that you know, the change in the environment that we're inflicting at the moment is catastrophic, and it's incredibly dangerous, not just aesthetically, but also in terms of our long-term survival. Mm-hmm. And I think people are starting to realize that. And I just noticed in the last few years in particular, we're seeing big impacts in climate, in change in climate, really big. For instance, that's going to have radical effects on all sorts of aspects of our lives. So it's not just an aesthetic thing, like, isn't it sad that there's not so many trees around to look at anymore? I think we really need to fundamentally re-examine the way that we interact with natural systems and the way that we draw on resources from nature, because it's not an inexhaustible supply. There's a finite limit into the amount that we can destroy or change until we run out. So that's one thing. But I think also it's not just a simple message of environmentalism or anything like that. For me, I think there is an increased understanding and awareness that artificial systems do have a lot in common with real systems, and that your understanding of real systems is enhanced by looking at these artificial systems in ways that mightn't have been possible if you just look at the real system. So when you sit down with an artificial life program and you start to experience it and to experiment with it, it really does change the way that you think about the real world, the way that the value that you put on nature and so on. And it doesn't make it any less, it in fact makes it greater. So I think it's a very complex problem. I mean, there is the potential to make artificial systems that are very, very interesting, very exciting, and you know, dare I say, even very natural, very what might have the appearances of being natural. Mm-hmm. But also, it's a precarious position because real biology that we're destroying is irreplaceable. We can't go back, and if a species becomes extinct, then the chances of getting that species back are very, very small indeed. Whereas I guess in an artificial life world, as long as your hard disk doesn't get corrupted, then you're fine. You can go back and get things that are extinct. So it's easy to make glib statements like that, but really the value of real nature becomes much more apparent, I think, when you work with artificial systems, because you get a new appreciation of what, you know, how complex nature is, how intricate it is, and how changes in one area can have radical effects throughout. They can propagate through very large spaces and make changes that you never anticipated when you started thinking about what the effects of a local change might be.
Following that line of thought, could you talk a little about cellular automata and your work with them?
Sorry, I didn't hear that. Can you say it again?
Yeah, following that line of thought, could you speak a little bit about cellular automata and your work with them?
Oh, okay. Well, cellular automata were invented in the early days of computing, and it's quite an interesting idea. It goes back to a problem that a guy called John von Neumann, who was a mathematician, had. His idea was that he wanted to make machines that could make copies of themselves, which in a way is the basis of living systems, is that living systems are able to make copies of themselves. And so von Neumann wanted to make machines that basically could make copies of themselves. Mm-hmm. So with a friend of his, Stan Uhlen, who's also a famous mathematician, they devised this very simple world called the cellular automata world. And it's basically like a kind of toy universe, and it has very simple physical rules. And the interesting thing about this tiny physical world is that toy universe is that you can get really complex and intricate behaviors that emerge from it. So basically it just consists of a grid of cells, and the cells have a state, which can just be like a number or something, on or off, or more values than that, and they look at what happens in their local neighbourhood. So they look at their immediate neighbours, and they make a change, turning themselves on or off, for instance, based on changes in the local neighbourhood. So there's a very famous example of cellular automata called the Game of Life, which was invented by another mathematician, since mathematicians are really interested in these things, John Conway, and it has very simple rules. It just says if you have neighbours, two or three neighbours, then stay on. If you have more than three neighbours, then turn off because you die from overcrowding. And if you have less than two neighbours, then you die from loneliness. And those simple rules are capable of creating very, very complex emergent behaviours, as we were talking about before. And it's really sort of one of the things that's fascinated people for the last 50 years or longer, is the idea that something as simple as just those two or three rules on a very simple grid can generate shapes and forms of incredible complexity. And it turns out that you can actually create a computer that exists on the grid of cells, and so it's capable of doing anything that a normal computer can do, I mean, probably much more slowly than a normal computer. So it's got huge sort of philosophical implications about living systems as well, even though it doesn't work in the same way as living systems, but just that such a simple system can generate such emergent complex behaviour is a really fascinating kind of, you know, property of the universe, if you like, even though this universe is a very simple toy universe. So there's certainly things like cellular automata are very influential in artificial life studies because they display, as I said, these emergent phenomena from such simple low-level interactions.
Do you see this approach as sort of a new paradigm that we're entering, this sort of looking at systems in particular as emergent systems?
Well, it has been around for a while. I mean, like, so as I said, TE automata were basically the first investigations in the early 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
So in some sense, it's not new. I think artificial life basically took a lot of these different ideas in synthesis and computation that were very much what you might call bottom-up, is that they start with low-level, simple interactions. And so rather than traditional AI, which tries to solve problems by decomposing a hard problem from the top down, these systems basically start from the bottom with simple interactions and then things emerge at the top. Now, the problem with that is that you don't necessarily know what it is that's going to emerge at the top. And so it requires this curious experimental process of changing the rules, playing around with the low-level interactions, running the system and seeing what actually eventuates, and that's what gives you the surprise and interest. So I think, in recent years, people have adopted this way of working in a whole lot of different disciplines, and I think it has changed the way that people, certainly in terms of computing and in terms of biology, there's a lot of interest in it as well, in terms of, you know, biological modelling and so on. I think it says also a lot about our desire to understand the world too, is that the sort of, you know, the older AI way was to work symbolically and decompose a problem from the top down, and this alternative method is a bottom-up approach. And really, I think it's turned out that both methods have some benefits and some disadvantages, and so in the longer term, I think you'll see a lot more emphasis on this idea of emergent behaviour, but it's not like a panacea to every problem. You can't necessarily get every system to be emergent. It turns out that most systems aren't emergent at all, and they're in fact really, really boring. So it's finding the interesting ones that is the problem. And again, that sort of becomes more of a top-down approach. So probably the long answer to your question is that it's still ambiguous, although I think it has had a significant impact on the way that people think about the world and the way that you can design computer systems, as I said before, in terms of generating things, generating behaviours, forms, shapes, ideas that you didn't explicitly program into the system.
Shifting back to the idea of evolutionary art and music, in your paper on open problems in evolutionary music and art, you state that success of this kind of work has been fairly limited. I'm wondering if you can explain exactly why you feel this way and what you see as a possible solution.
Okay. Well, I think most people who've worked in this area, they've done some interesting things, but a large amount of the effort, I think, is really focused on technical solutions to some fairly limited problems. So the idea behind, working on that paper and some of the ideas that it presents was to say, well, what are the things that are really important in this area, and what would we judge to be significant achievements if they were to be made? And I think one of them is that we find we can create systems that have some art-making ability in themselves. So rather than being systems that are programmed to make art of a certain kind, that they're more open-ended in that they can make art in general. Now, that's a very difficult proposition and probably something that mightn't be solved, if ever, for a very long period of time. I think one of the problems with existing systems is that they're very limited in the domain that they can basically exploit, if you like. So if you think about it, a very famous example in artificial intelligence is the idea that a computer chess program could beat, world champion chess player. I don't think a similar challenge is useful in an artistic sense, is that can we make a computer program that makes art better than our best artists? I don't think that's a very useful challenge, because even the idea of one piece of art being better than the other is problematic.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do think is interesting is that can we make autonomous systems, that is computer-based systems, for instance, that are capable of independently producing what we might recognize as creative behavior. So mm-hmm. just as artificial life is looking at the idea of can we instantiate the idea of living systems in a computer, what I'm saying is can we make computer systems that exhibit some form of creative behavior. Now, whether that creative behavior is really like the creative behavior that we are familiar with in humans, it's probably not going to be, but at least can we recognize it as being creative? And that's much more of an interesting and challenging problem, I think.
Definitely, that is interesting. We are pretty much out of time, I'm afraid, but maybe on a closing note, if you could just discuss how you see yourself in terms of the relationship between being an artist, a researcher, and a programmer.
Well, I think it's often a very difficult one because, I mean, you know, the old idea of C.P. Snow and the two cultures is that, you know, science and art are two very different fields, and I think largely that's still true today. But if you go a little bit deeper, I think you find that it is actually a very fascinating area and that it's challenging in terms of different language systems and different ideas, but it ultimately can be very rewarding. And, you know, ultimately the reason why I do the work that I do is because I just find it incredibly fascinating and I'm, you know, really lucky to be able to work in this area. Yes, there are problems between art and science in terms of communication and language and so on, but if you can get beyond those, it can be very fruitful and very productive.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, John. I really appreciate it, despite our technical difficulties here.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure to talk to you. And perhaps if you could, you could ask any listeners to visit my website if they're interested in more information. That would be a good way to find out more about my work.
And what is your website? For our listeners?
Okay, it's a big mouthful. So it's www.csse.monash.edu.au. And if you search for John McCormack from there, you should be able to find it. Or alternatively, you can just Google John McCormack with no H in John, J-O-N, and usually that comes up with the right person.
And there is also a link to John McCormack's site on the Different Bits website on Enemy Combatant Radio on the event for Interview with John McCormack. We link to your site. Well, thank you very much. Any chance your work will be coming to the United States anytime soon?
I don't have any current plans. It has been shown in the US before several times. If anything comes up, I usually put it on my webpage so I can let anybody know who's interested where it's next going to be available. I do have a book that's out too, which you can purchase over the internet, which has got video documentation of a lot of my work. So I'd suggest for anyone who's interested in actually seeing it, if it's not been exhibited at any location near you, that looking at the book and the DVD is probably a good way to get a good sense of what it's all about.
Well, thanks again. Have a good day over there in Australia.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me.
We'll have a good night. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Bye.
So that was John McCormack on the line from Australia, joining us to discuss artificial life and art. Archive will be up this evening on Enemy Combatant Radio in case you missed any of it. And coming up next week, we will have Scott Draves, who will join us to talk about his experiments in complex visualization of similar kinds of stuff, actually more sort of A-lifey kind of stuff. So he is a local San Franciscan. He'll be in the studio next week. Tune in for that. See you next week.